Thanks so much, Celeste, and many thanks to the organizers of this event. It's very pleasant to be back in California again, and obviously it's a great privilege to be at Berkeley. I must apologize for delivering this seated, which is a little more awkward, but owing to a bad leg, I have to do that. So this talk, I think this is all right, huh? In this talk today or tonight, I want to say a little more about the theory of postmodernity and perhaps augment it in some new and unfamiliar ways in the direction of finance capital, for example, and in that of politics and globalization. I understand that globalization is an old-fashioned word now and people are supposed to say neoliberalism, but I think those are really not the same exactly, and so I go on using it. I think postmodernity may also be an old-fashioned word, but I need to correct some misconceptions about it, which can be clarified by disentangling postmodernity itself from postmodernism. The latter is essentially adjectival. It mainly characterizes aesthetic production, when not philosophy itself. And this is the sense in which people say that postmodernism is over and done with, that we now have neoconceptualism or some other style or fashion. But on my view, postmodernity is a historical and a periodizing concept, one way of naming the third stage of capitalism, or the age of globalization, or the era of finance capital, and so on and so forth. I think that people began to become aware that we were entering a new historical moment around 1980, but I also think you'll agree that used in this periodizing fashion, it wouldn't make much sense to argue that postmodernity is passé, unless you think that we've already gone through some immense historical transformation in the last few years. Which some people, I guess, do believe. So while it seems to me perfectly proper to talk about postmodern architecture or the postmodern novel and to theorize those forms, as we will do in somewhat different way in a moment, I believe they must be grasped as symptoms of that transformation which is postmodernity as a whole. We might say expressions of its structure, but after all, symptoms are also expressions, and the diagnostic word perhaps better captures the dimension of the unconscious at work here, the dimension of the artistic phenomenon, which demands decipherment and interpretation. Meanwhile, the postmodern has also frequently been understood as a way of thinking or even a kind of philosophy, and I think there are thinkers out there who actually call themselves postmodern philosophers and who characterize what they do as postmodern philosophy. And I suppose I have no objection to that either. And as far as the tenets of this new kind of philosophy are concerned, I assume they include anti-foundationalism, anti-essentialism, and the proposition that truth is not a representational matter, something often stigmatized by older fashion philosophers and other enemies of the postmodern as relativism. Add constructivism to all that, and I don't mind endorsing it myself, except that I have to add that as far as I'm concerned, philosophy itself is a symptom like art, and that postmodern philosophy is not a new kind of truth, but rather simply an expression and a symptom of that whole new system and structure which I've been calling postmodernity. As such. What I propose to do here is then to examine in turn various kinds of symptoms or expressions of postmodernity. Symptoms in the realm of the aesthetic, as is my title, The Aesthetics of Singularity, and of taste, in that of economics, in that of concepts, and of social phenomenology, and finally, in that of politics if we get that far, and I should really keep an eye on her, as I don't need to keep you forever. But my remarks about philosophy will also make clear why I think that the claims of all its subfields are equally null and void. Marxism and psychoanalysis are not philosophies, but rather something else. But political philosophy, or what passes for it, is as dead as a doornail, and so is aesthetics, and as for ethics, as such, non parlons pas. It is at any rate with aesthetics that we begin, because I think it'll clarify this title and make it a little clearer why I thought it useful and suggestive to range so many other topics, the economic, the social, the political, under that ostensibly aesthetic rubric, because this is not really a paper about art, although it might seem that way for a while. So with that, we may proceed to this disreputable thing, which is aesthetics, or the science of beauty. And to those peculiar kinds of art produced today, which are so different from the various traditional kinds that one sometimes wonders whether it's worth using the same word for all of them, and that would be another reason for abandoning aesthetics as such, as some kind of standardizing rubric. Now, many distinguished critics have evoked the volatilization of the art object in recent times, and I'll simply presuppose all those discussions by taking as my privileged example of contemporary art the installation as such. We don't do easel paintings anymore or statues, but we do often come upon these spatial exhibits in which various disparate and unrelated kinds of objects are somehow juxtaposed. A heap of pebbles, say, a framed picture on the wall, maybe a rusty lawnmower and a dead bird, a sample of graffiti, and an antique armchair or sofa. Now, none of those objects, which make up the installation, is the objet d'art itself. And if the collection is a work, then its logic lies in their interrelationality. But where is that relationship? In space, to be sure, this is spatial art, but is it in our minds and our purely private associations? Paintings have style and bear the mark of a subjectivity, but the arrangement of the installation is utterly impersonal and in that sense styleless, even though presumably it corresponds to someone's choices, although it's not clear itself an idea or a theme or a statement. We can draw a few initial conclusions from these first observations. First of all, clearly enough, the installation marks a significant disintegration of the old classical system of the fine arts, if not its complete restructuration. In a movement characteristic of the postmodern, the arts, which in modernity developed in a regime of differentiation, each art tending towards a kind of autonomy or semi-autonomy in its own right, the arts now in the postmodern reverse that direction and conflate, falling back on one another in new and unexpected symbioses. So it is that photography, once a poor cousin of painting, has become in postmodernity a major art, but has also known all kinds of hybridizations and graftings with the other arts. This is something maybe of an equivalent of the supersession of fiction by nonfiction in literature. I'm really not going to speak about literature tonight. And it is, of course, an unsurprising development in the society of the spectacle, where we're already bombarded by thousands of images a day in real life. But it should also be remembered that photography is an abstraction of the visual and the tactile, the bodily. And this matter of postmodern abstraction, what I'll call second-degree abstraction, is crucial, it seems to me. Meanwhile, the hybridization of the arts gives us yet another reason why the search for some unique density and perfection in any given art is no longer a viable ambition. Two more developments need to be mentioned at this point. If the individual arts no longer have any telos or momentum of their own, as they did in the modern, or so we're told, then it also becomes somewhat more comprehensible why the avant-gardes should have ceased to exist today. Clearly, this vanishing of the avant-garde as such, perhaps Cobra and Situationism were the last of the species, that vanishing has other determinants as well, and in particular, the weakening of collective structures and the crisis of politics. I mean party politics, in so much as the vanguard party had a fundamental relationship to the vanguard artistic movement and vice versa. But has anything taken the place of the avant-garde on the current scene? I believe that here again the installation gives us a clue, for does this assemblage of heterogeneous objects and items in a momentary constellation not have its macro equivalent in the very contemporary museum itself, with its heteroclite shows and its ingeniously themed and equally ephemeral exhibitions? The conclusion is inescapable. The collective avant-garde has in our time and in postmodernity been replaced by the single figure of the curator, who now becomes the demiurge of those floating and dissolving constellations of strange objects we still call art. In that case, maybe we don't have any great artists any longer, we have great curators, and maybe we need to look more closely at this novel and creative figure today, whose structural position may be expected to have an equivalent in other realms of the information society, such as medicine or the university, business administration, and government itself. And I think that doctors, I hope there aren't any in here, really curate pharmaceuticals nowadays and much less follow their traditional role. If for Adorno, the virtuoso conductor was the very image of the emergent dictator in 19th century bourgeois politics, such as Napoleon III would be the example, what may not the curatorial role have to tell us about our own systems of power? But since I seemed to disparage philosophy a moment ago, I probably have some kind of moral obligation to suggest that what's replaced philosophy in our own time, namely theory, is also perhaps a kind of curatorial practice, selecting name bits from our various theoretical or philosophical sources, putting them all together in a kind of conceptual installation in which we marvel at the new intellectual space thereby momentarily produced. But there's a nastier side of the curator yet to be mentioned. And that can easily be grasped if we look at installations and indeed entire exhibits in the newer postmodern museums as having their distant and more primitive ancestors in the happenings of the 1960s. Artistic phenomena equally spatial, equally devoid of personal style, equally non-objective, equally ephemeral. The difference lies not only in the absence of humans from the installation, and indeed, save for the curator, from the museum itself, it lies in the very presence of the institution itself. Everything is subsumed under the institution. Indeed, the curator may be said to be something like its embodiment, its allegorical personification. In postmodernity, we no longer exist in a world on a human scale. Institutions have in some sense become autonomous, but certainly in another, they transcend the dimensions of any individual, whether master or servant. Something that can also be grasped by reminding ourselves of the dimension of globalization in which institutions today exist, the museum very much included. But these institutions are no longer to be conceived along the lines of machines or the factory, or in terms of what used to be called the state. Communications technology requires us to think of them as informational institutions, perhaps, or immense cyberspace constructions. Yet the reminder of the happening suggests yet another characteristic of the newer art and of the installation in particular, and also explains why these newer works, if we can still call them that, are at any rate no longer objects, whatever else they may be. But now we can see a little better what they really are. They're not objects because they are, in fact, events. The installation and its kindred productions are made not for posterity or even for the permanent collection, but rather for the now and for a temporality which may rather be rather different from the old modernist kind. This is indeed why it's become appropriate to speak of it, of the newer art, not as a work or a style, nor even as the expression of something deeper, but rather as a strategy or a recipe, a strategy for producing an event, a recipe for events. Jumping ahead to politics for a second, can we not see the great mass demonstrations, the flash crowds, as the equivalent of just such events, rather different from the old-fashioned revolutionary conspiracies? Symptoms of a different temporality, rather than signs of the emergence of something like the people or even direct democracy, but we'll get to politics later. One final observation before we try to say what kind of an event these postmodern artistic happenings might be. I mentioned technology a while back. Did I say that in our postmodern age, we not only use technology, we consume it, and we consume its exchange value along with the rest of its more symbolic essence? Just as in an older period, the automobile was consumed as much for its libidinal value and its symbolic overtones as for its practical use value, so today, but in a far more complex way, the computer and the internet and their ramifications, already well integrated into utopian political fantasies, have replaced an older artistic and cultural consumption, which they have both modified and supplanted. We now consume the very form of communication along with its content. But this distinction between form and content now brings me to the essentials of what I wanted to observe about art today in what is not only a postmodern but also a theoretical age. The great Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem once wrote a series of book reviews of imaginary books, books from the future, which neither he nor anyone else would ever write. It was a prophetic gesture and demonstrated that you could consume the idea of a book with as much satisfaction as the real book itself. How then to characterize the spirit of the newer works? I want to go back to that older category of art criticism which invoked inspiration, the Einfall, the idea for a work, and to adapt it to this newer production for which the idea is a kind of technical discovery or perhaps an invention in the sense of the contraptions of lonely crackpot inventors or obsessives. Art today is generated by a single bright idea which, combining form and content, can be repeated ad infinitum until the artist's name takes on a kind of content of its own. Thus, the Chinese artist Xu Bing conceived the idea of making up conjunctures of lines or strokes that looked like real Chinese characters but were utterly without meaning. We might think of nonsense words or Zaum or Khlebnikov's made-up language, yet these Western phenomena really have no equivalent for the visual dimension of the Chinese system. This was thus a remarkable conception or Einfall, a discovery of genius, if you like, provided it's understood that it constitutes Xu Bing's discovery neither a formal innovation, nor the elaboration of a style, nor is it auto-referential in the modernist sense, or even aesthetic in the sense of altering or estranging perception or intensifying it. The question that interests me is whether we can call this art conceptual in a now older and henceforth more traditional sense. I understand the older conceptual art as the production of physical objects which flex mental categories by pitting them against each other. Yet these categories, whether we can express them or not, are somehow universal forms, like Kant's categories or Hegel's moments, and conceptual objects, the older conceptualist objects, are therefore a little like antinomies or paradoxes or zen koan in the verbal philosophical realm, occasions for a meditative practice. But postmodern neoconceptualism is not at all like this. Production with Xu Bing and the rest of a postmodern artistic production for which I take him to be paradigmatic, it seems to me that the situation is wholly different. His texts are as it were, soaked in theory. They are as theoretical as they are visual, but they don't illustrate an idea, nor do they offer material for a meditation or a mental or conceptual exercise. A concept is there, but it's singular. And this conceptual art is nominalistic rather than universal. Today we consume not the work, but the idea of the work, as in Lem's imaginary book reviews. And the work itself, if we can still call it that, is a mixture of theory and singularity. It is not material. We consume an idea rather than a sensory presence. And it is not subject to aesthetic universalism, insofar as each of these artifacts reinvents the very idea of art in a new and non-universalizable form, so that it is in that sense even doubtful whether we should use the general term art at all for such singularity events. Well, I haven't forgotten that I promised to draw some analogies and indeed relationships between this newer kind of art and other contemporary practices, such as some new kind of postmodern economics. But I can't resist inserting here a different kind of example of the postmodern aesthetic event. It will be brief, as the portions are in any case so small, and I refer to postmodern cuisine, as it is exemplified in Ferran Adrià's now famous restaurant, El Bui, it's closed now, in what is sometimes called, he doesn't like the term, I think, molecular cooking. The 35 courses that make up a meal at El Bui are all unfamiliar looking, or if they look familiar, you're in for a shock when you taste them. They are no longer natural objects, or perhaps I should say they're no longer realistic objects. Rather, they are abstractions of the natural, the taste of asparagus, for example, or of eggplant or persimmon, has been separated from the body of its natural container and incarnated in a new texture and form. Not only the famous foam, whose heyday at El Bui goes back to an earlier period, I believe, but little caviar shapes, melon balls or liquids, sponges, folds, and the like. Meanwhile, the new form is important in and of itself, and each new item is recorded and registered not only by a written and then computerized recipe, I don't think they're cooked again, though, after each season, and then by photography. It is the image that's preserved, and you consume the image along with the idea. Indeed, you consume the conjuncture of elements in what is, just like postmodern art itself, a unique event. The older foods, whether in the realism of classical cuisine or the modernism of the nouvelle variety, were still classified under the great universals, seafood, meat, vegetables, spices, and the like. These astronaut snacks of El Bui, as someone has called them, have radically escaped the domination of the universal and its naming systems. They are, in other words, singular in all the heightened significance postmodern philosophy has given to that term and to which we will eventually confront later on. Now, in all of this, I haven't lost sight of my own starting point, which was actually not aesthetic but economic, and indeed turned on that peculiar form of the singularity called the derivative. The postmodern text, to use a more neutral term than work, the postmodern artistic singularity effect, if you prefer, is of the same unique type as that unique one-time financial instrument called the derivative. Such is what at least I wanted to argue here. Both are at least in part the result of the situation of globalization in which multiple determinants in constant transformation at different rates of speed henceforth make any stable structure problematic, unless it's simply a pastiche of forms of the past. The world financial market is mirrored in the world art market thrown open by the end of modernism and of its Eurocentric canon of masterworks, along with the implicit or explicit teleology that informed it. Now, to be sure, anything and everything is possible, but only on condition it embrace ephemerality and consent to exist but for a brief time as an event rather than a durable structure. Now, no description of the postmodern can omit the centrality of the postmodern economy, which can succinctly be characterized as the dominance of finance capital over all old-fashioned production. But I must here limit myself to a single illustration of this process, albeit a very significant one at that, and that is, as I've said, the strange and unique mutation of traditional insurance and investment into what's called the derivative. Now, it's not possible to project a concept of the derivative, that is a universal, it has a name, but it has no idea, for reasons that you'll understand shortly. Any example of the derivative will thus be non-exemplary and different from any other one, and yet perhaps a very oversimplified model can give a sense of it. I take this from an excellent little book by Leon LaPuma. It can give a sense of it along with its indissoluble relationship to globalization, because this is something that's only possible in globalization. So LaPuma and Lee imagine the following. A U.S. corporation contracting to provide 10 million cellular phones to a Brazilian subsidiary of a South African corporation. Its interior architecture of the cell phone will be produced by a German-Italian corporation, its casings by a Mexican manufacturer, and a Japanese firm will also provide other components. So here we have at least six different currencies, and their exchange rates are in perpetual flux, as is the standard norm in globalization today after the end of Bretton Woods, gold, the end of the dollar, and so on and so forth. These are changing all the time. People are betting on various currencies. They rise and fall. So these six things are not stable. The relationship of each of these exchange rates to the others will be stabilized, that is to say, will be guaranteed by a kind of insurance. That makes many different insurance contracts, maybe six or seven, I think probably many more. And it's this entire package of distinct insurance contracts which will make up that financial instrument, which is this unique derivative in question. Now, obviously, the situation and the instrument will always, in reality, be far more complicated than that. But what's clear is that even taking the old-fashioned futures market on beef or corn or something as a kind of simplified and primitive ancestor, there can never be another derivative exactly like the one I've described in its structure and requirements. They are all radically, by nature, distinct from each other. So, indeed, it is more like a unique event than it is a contract, something with a stable structure and a juridical status, and is a universal. Contracts are universals. Meanwhile, as the authors point out, this derivative can be inspected and analyzed only after the fact, such that for knowledge, this event exists only in the past. The authors conclude pessimistically that there can never be genuine regulation of such a transaction, since each one is radically different, so you can't form a general law to govern them, or to moderate the dynamics of this kind of instrument, which no less an authority than Warren Buffett has called the financial equivalent of the nuclear bomb. Now I need to interrupt myself this time to ask myself a question, indeed something of a hostile question of the type you yourself might be meditating. I forestall you in this then. It's this. You, that is to say me, have been arguing for a kind of contemporary imprisonment in the present, reduction to the body, as you call this temporality elsewhere, an existential but also collective loss of historicity in such a way that the future fades away as unthinkable or unimaginable, while the past itself turns into dusty images and Hollywood-type pictures of actors in wigs and the like. Clearly, this is a political diagnosis as well as an existential or phenomenological one, since it's intended to indict our current paralysis, political paralysis, and inability to imagine, let alone to organize the future and future change. Yet your, that's me, your illustration or symbol or allegory for all this is the derivative, which is in fact, as I just said, a descendant of the old futures markets, which are essentially bets on the future of meat and cotton and grain. So even though derivatives may be more complex in the sense that they seem to be bets on bets rather than on real harvests, is there not a dimension of futurity in them which itself contradicts and refutes your temporal and even political diagnosis here? Good question. But we're talking about thinking historically, the loss of history in this diagnosis. So let me say that I'm not really sure that any social order or mode of production so far has ever really managed to project the future of collective time adequately or successfully. Social classes have sometimes been able to, securing their hegemony over long periods of inevitable decline, some of them indeed organizing their own rise to power. Nor am I sure that our images of the future are mainly intended as prophecies or predictions. Some surely function to energize us collectively, others, maybe equally intentionally, to keep us in a disarmed state of paralysis or depression. So what is true futurity? What is the sense of history exactly? We can be sure it's not some affect-laden dystopia, some religiously inspired image of redemption. The businessmen and the economists try to appropriate the future by way of multiple scenarios, constructed out of a combination of human and institutional motivation and tendency. It's all rather short-term and organized around categories of success or failure, which don't seem to me appropriate for human collectivities. This game playing of the businessmen, the economists, really corresponds to historiography rather than historicity. For Heidegger, history and its future was a matter of a generational mission, something which in hindsight may seem ominous enough, but which does seem better than having no mission at all. I myself feel that for the moment and in our current situation, a sense of history can only be awakened by some presiding vision of utopia lying beyond our current system. At any rate, at least in part, it is a dull reflex of dystopian futurity that we see when we turn to our next topic, virtually our central one, namely the idea of singularity itself, which seems to me actually to have four quite different and even antagonistic meanings. The first one is philosophical and indeed derives from the old nominalism debates in which singularity is opposed to particularity. The latter, particularity, is an individual item which one can nonetheless subsume under a general category or idea. In that sense, the particular always goes hand in hand with the general. Singularity, however, proposes something unique which resists the general and the universalizing. In that sense, it can have no content as an idea and is merely a designation for what resists all subsumption. It is the existentialist perennial cry against system and the anarchist's fierce resistance to the state. I argue that in whatever form, singularity is one of the dominant value categories of postmodernity, and that paradoxically, or even dialectically, in a spatial age, singularity has become an event, a form of temporality. Then, in second place, there one would no doubt wish to mention the scientific use of this word, where it doesn't seem clear to me, at least, whether singularity means something beyond physical law as we know it, or something anomalous which has not yet been explained by scientists, but which will eventually fall under an enlarged scientific law of some kind as yet to be theorized, the theory of everything, for example. What's useful here is then the notion of a singularity event like a black hole, which, as in the financial dynamics of derivatives we've just outlined, lies on the border between an unrepeatable event in time of some sort and a unique structure which may come together just once, but which is nonetheless a structure of some kind and susceptible to structural analysis. Then, third meaning, in science fiction, this clearly becomes the dominant ambiguity. But rather than with black holes and subatomic particles, the subatomic peculiarities of the physicists, this version of singularity is linked to computers and artificial intelligence. Here, the singularity is projected as a leap or revolutionary mutation of some sort, something that can be dystopian or utopian, according to the context. Dystopian singularity would be the emergence of a mechanical species that transcends the human in its intelligence and its malignity, as in the Terminator series or Battlestar Galactica. Utopia would then be the emergence of the post-human in the hitherto human species, a kind of mutation of the human in a new hybrid or android type of superhuman intelligence within our own human nature. Ray Kurzweil has become famous for his prediction of a very specific singularity, namely the date at which, I think it's 2056 or something, as in the film Terminator, artificial intelligence will catch up to and surpass human agency, and we will enter a whole new era whose heroic struggles have already been recorded for us in numerous films and TV series like the ones I've mentioned. Now, a colleague reminds me that derivatives, the computations that make up derivatives cannot be thought by the human mind. They can only be produced by computers. So maybe this singularity has already taken place. At any rate, this third kind of singularity is the very epitome of that return of the repressed, of a future we're no longer able to imagine, but which insists on marking its imminence with nightmarish anxiety. Someone once said, we can imagine the end of the world more easily than we can imagine the end of capitalism. And that more or less illustrates the point I'm trying to make here about history in an ahistorical age, temporality in a world in which we live only in the present, spatially. But this third use seems the farthest from the usage that interests us here, save that its visionary notion of a period or evolutionary leap does somehow correspond to the problems of periodization and postmodernity, and the emergence of new perceptions, new forms of experience, maybe even new kinds of human beings, as in avant-garde politics, if we had any. Now, I take so-called postmodern philosophy, as I've said, as another symptom of postmodernity, along with the other features I've been describing, such as the work of art, food, derivatives, and so forth. But in order to grasp the significance of postmodern philosophy and of singularity's place in it. In order to separate, we must move from the three uses of the word I've mentioned to a fourth one, which is, I think, a sociopolitical one, in which the struggle against universals inherent in the very concept of singularity is a struggle against hegemonic norms and institutional values, whether cultural or juridical or political. Universals are here in this fourth kind of singularity felt to be normative and thereby oppressive and binding on minorities and on individuals, oppressive of minorities and individuals. If you posit some universal human nature, in other words, you're already affirming a norm from which all deviations, whether collective or individual, can be denounced and condemned. And to denounce such norms becomes a burning political issue, as in the Republican primaries today, or in identity politics, or the politics of secessionist groups and marginal or oppressed cultures. For at their outer limit, the hegemonic or oppressive norm can reach genocide and the ideals of ethnic cleansing, while we can also witness it in some more positive form everywhere as a reaction against imperialism, standardization, and against the deterioration of national autonomies under globalization. Yet even this seemingly legitimate resistance to oppressive norms and universals remains, I think, dialectically ambivalent. That is to say, it cannot be thought in terms of ordinary logic which uses universals. The most dramatic examples are, of course, to be found in the areas of feminism and gender preference. For to assert universal rights for women is also necessarily to challenge cultures in which another status of women is prescribed. The doctrine of universal human rights is still a doctrine of universals. Yet the repudiation of such universals is equally contradictory, for just as individual cultures can challenge the universal norm of an ascribed human nature, which nowadays is generally an American one, so also women can challenge the universalizing norm inherent in this or that cultural custom or law. Now we have very little time, to deal with what are perhaps our most important topics, the transformation of subjectivity and lived experience in the postmodern and the transformation of politics. For subjectivity itself and personal experience, I've already mentioned a kind of displacement from the experience of time to that of space. Maybe I've talked about that elsewhere. But surely the center of our subjective experience, our phenomenological or existential experience, has to remain temporal somehow. We would then, in that case, need to see what temporality feels like under the regime of space. And I think this involves something more drastic than the old Bergsonian critique of spatial experience in terms of some deep time or élan vital, some authentic time. I think it could be argued that all the fascination of modernism with deep time, not only in Bergson, but also in Thomas Mann or Proust, that such fascination derived from the unevenness of the modernizing world, the coexistence of slower village or rural temporalities with the dizzying rapidity of the big cities and of industrialization. So modernism is in that sense the expression of incomplete modernization. And we can draw the conclusion that the postmodern is what we get when modernization is complete, when the countryside is abolished, that is to say, when the peasantry have become wage workers and the older agriculture has been transformed into agribusiness. Now, in this more complete modernization, even the differences between industrial labor and the life of the city bourgeoisie is effaced. Everyone is middle class. Everyone has become a consumer. Everyone is unemployed. Everything has become a shopping mall. Space has become an infinite extension of surfaces, which are images. And difference, a temporal phenomenon, has given way to identity and standardization. You'll observe that this is still only true in a few privileged spaces and countries in the world, but that makes my point, namely that today what constituted uneven development locally and nationally has now been projected onto a global scale. Culture itself has become a space of uneven development. The connection with globalization is now clear. This sense of a global or world scale could not have been possible in the modern period, the period of imperialism, of metropolises and colonies. It could only have become possible after decolonization. In our present context, we've been talking about business rather than national liberation, and it's not even of immense new multinational corporations, vastly beyond anything Lenin had in mind by monopoly in an older modernist period. We have to speak of the communications technologies that make these gigantic business transnationals possible, and this is a topic which leads in many directions that I won't explore here. McLuhan would certainly have identified the computer and the internet with fundamental modifications of subjectivity, and he would have been right. The cultural specialists in media technology would then have their own word to speak on its transformation of the body and the phenomenology of the object world. It seems to me no accident that cultural theory today has been so radically transformed by the technological perspectives of the new media, and we've already underscored the significance of finance capital. In this context, however, it remains to stress the way in which, in computerization, spatial distance is now translated into a virtual temporal simultaneity, and in which, in other words, here too, space abolishes time. Investments, speculation, the selling off of whole national currencies, divestments and acquisitions, the commodification of a future you can buy and sell. The newer communications technologies have accelerated these processes to the point where the passage of time, Bergsonian durée, has been virtually eliminated. As can be imagined, such an eclipse of time passing seriously modifies human experience if it does not, in fact, gravely amputate it. Back in the 20th century, the filmmaker Ken Russell predicted that in the 21st century, standard feature films would run no longer than 15 minutes. And in a sense, he was right, and popular culture gives us many hints about this phenomenon, which is equivalent to the disappearance of plot. Action films today really have no plot. What plot remains is a pretext for explosive events that fill up minute after minute of the viewing, that is, of the viewing present. I call this the end of temporality, the reduction to the body and the present. What's sought for is an intensity of the present, the before and after tends to disappear. And clearly enough, this is something that happens to our sense of history as well. No previous societies have had as little functional memory, as little sense of the historical past as this one, and clearly the disappearance of the past entails the disappearance of the future as well in the long term. No one believes in long-term societal change any longer. Our present is hemmed in by an evaluation of the past as either failed or successful modernization, that simply means getting rich, and by a conception of the future as impending natural and ecological disaster. Such are only some of the consequences of a primacy of space over time in postmodernity. Now, all of this has much to do with the transformation of the individual subject today. At the first stirrings of postmodernity, the structuralists and post-structuralists spoke of the death of the subject, by which they meant, in less melodramatic language, the increasing fragility and vulnerability of an older bourgeois individualism, its deterioration under conditions of large-scale institutions, and the decline of that capitalist competition which brought individual into being in the first place as an acquisitive and aggressive ego and a powerful and edible identity. All the features I've attributed to some properly postmodern subjectivity are to be understood in terms of that process, it seems to me. The reduction to the present, the body is some last reality to survive the exhaustion of bourgeois culture, the mutability and changeability, variability of mood, replacing or affect, replacing the self-confident stances of an older emotional system. How much the more so, then, will not subjectivity be transformed when opened to the vicissitudes of that even vaster landscape, which is globalization itself? No longer protected by family or region or even by the nation itself, a national identity, the emergence of the vulnerable subject into a world of billions of anonymous equals is bound to bring about still more momentous changes in human reality. In hindsight, we can look at globalization or this third stage of capitalism as the other side or face of that immense movement of decolonization and liberation which took place all over the world in the 1960s, beginning, I guess, with Ghana in 1957. The first two stages of capitalism, the period of national industries and markets, followed by that of imperialism and the acquisition of colonies, the development of some properly colonial world economy. These first two moments were characterized by the construction of otherness on a world scale. First, the various nation states organized their populations into competing national groups who could only feel their identities by way of xenophobia and the hatred of the national enemy, who could only define their identity by opposition to their opposite numbers. But these nationalisms quickly enough took on non-national form, as particularly in Europe, the various minorities and other language speakers evolved their own national projects. Then, in that gradual enlargement, which is not to be confused with the later globalization, the systems of imperialism began to colonize the world in terms of the otherness of their colonized subjects. Racial otherness and a Eurocentric or Americanocentric contempt for so-called underdeveloped or weak or subaltern cultures partitioned so-called modern people from those who were still pre-modern and separated advanced or ruling cultures from the dominated. With this moment of imperialism, modernity, the second stage of capitalism, a worldwide system of otherness is established. It will be clear then that with decolonization, all that is gradually swept away. Those subaltern others who could not speak for themselves, let alone rule themselves, now for the first time, as Jean-Paul Sartre famously put it, speak in their own voice and claim their own existential freedom. Now suddenly, the bourgeois subject, the Western subject, is reduced to equality with all those former others, and a new kind of anonymity reigns throughout world society as a whole, a good anonymity. Billions of real people now exist, and not just the millions of your own nation and your own language speakers. Now, what does all this have to do with politics? I'll conclude with a few remarks on the political in postmodernity, remarks which are descriptive and don't pretend to offer any solutions or even my own personal opinions and positions on the subject. But since we were talking about space, I'll put a very simple proposition to you, namely that today all politics is about real estate. Postmodern politics is essentially a matter of land grabs on a local as well as a global scale. Whether you think of the question of Palestine, the settlements and the camps, or of the politics of raw materials and extractions in Africa, whether you think of ecology in the rainforest, or the problems of federalism, citizenship, and immigration, or whether it's a question of gentrification in the great cities, as well as bidonville, the favelas and the townships, and of course the movement of the landless, or whether you think simply of foreclosures in this current period of crisis. Today, everything is about land. In Marxist terms, all these struggles result from the commodification of land and the dissolution of the last remnants of feudalism and its peasantries, their replacement, as I said, with agricultural, industrial agriculture or agribusiness, and with farm workers. Where is time in all this? It's to be found in the new flash crowds enabled by cell phones and texting, the new mass demonstrations of Seattle and Tiananmen, of Eastern Europe, of Tahrir Square, and of Wisconsin, and of Occupy. These truly mark the emergence of what my friends Michael Hart and Tony Negri call multitude. But they're no longer the politics of duration, but the politics of the instant, of the present, what Negri himself has called constitutive power rather than constituted power. Postmodernity in general is characterized by this new kind of present time, a reduction of the present, a reduction of the body. In this new dialectic of omnipresent space and the temporal present, history, historicity, the sense of history, is the loser. The past is gone. We can no longer imagine the future. It's clear that this waning of history confronts those of us still committed to radical systemic change with some very real political problems. And perhaps then that's the moment to break off this survey. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. So first thing I'm going to do is announce that there will be an audio recording of tonight's lecture that will be available on the Townsend Center website, so you can tell your friends who weren't able to fit in the room, they can listen to it some other time. I also wanted to remind you that we have very brief time for questions. If you have a question that Professor Jameson didn't always already pose to himself, and I will cut you off mercilessly. But I also wanted to say that Professor Jameson has graciously offered to have office hours in the coffee shop of the Durant Hotel tomorrow. So please don't overwhelm him. But if you have a question that you cannot wait until noon to ask, you may see him there. Okay?
At 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
9 to 11. 9 to 11,
maybe. Okay. So there is a question. Fred, why don't you take your own... Pick your own.
Okay, I saw a hand way back there, but I don't see it now. Is there going to be a, there's no, is there some kind of...
The person who wants to ask the question, wait for the mic to come to you.
Go ahead,
yeah. Hello? Is this on?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm not sure what you were suggesting right in the end with Antonio Negri's notion, but up until that point, I had the following question. In this age of the spectacle, in the age of the infantization of late capitalism, if we're looking for an alternative, which seems to be a bleak prospect, unless we consider it a thrill, it seems to me it has something to do with the suffering of those people who are oppressed. And that strikes me as an ethical question. But if I'm not mistaken, right at the beginning of your talk, you dismissed ethics.
Yes, I do. I think these, a philosopher once responded to this habitual remark of mine about ethics by talking about cloning and so on and so forth. I think that stuff, those are political questions. I don't think they're ethical questions. I think ethical politics can be very powerful, but it wanes as soon as your indignation wanes, and as soon as some sop has been thrown to the thing itself. This is an argument I always have with my old friend and comrade Cornel West, as well. The Second International was really based on an ethical socialism, and I think on what ought to be and how we should correct correct suffering. And I just don't think that's the right. that's a successful way in which politics, that's a successful program for politics. And suffering is not the only way one can arouse political action. I think the example of energized political movements, the organization of the oppressed, for example, in camps, in genocidal situations, and so on and so forth, is maybe much more politically energizing. I think we don't have to be mesmerized by Agamben's image of the ultimate powerlessness of naked life, because that's a very rare phenomenon, it seems to me. Other questions? Oh, somebody over here,
oh, okay.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
My question has to do with one of the moments that I think it'll speak to today's moment. And it has to do with when you said the opposition to imperialism was all identity-based in this world of invented a new otherness. And it made me think about the difference between the way that kind of thinking led to Jean-Paul Sartre's idea and his friend Frantz Fanon, who actually criticizes that concept of negritude and identity politics and sees something very different in the particular, a reach for a universal in the form of humanism. And I think that applies to today's world, but I was wondering if you might comment on that.
Yeah, I think that's important to mention, but I don't know whether that humanism still has any great power for people. The problem of the universal community you can find in Sartre himself, really, but I always like a science fictional version of it. It's this. Groups define themselves against other groups, against threats from the outside. So the cohesive force of a group, or a social class, of course, is the enemy. And, of course, Carl Schmitt defined the political as postulating friend and foe. You don't have friends unless you have foes, and so forth. So Sartre himself comes to this question in the critique, which is unfinished, how there could ever be a universal collectivity without the existence of something threatening outside of us. And in Le Guin's Lathe of Heaven, if you know that wonderful book about Portland, the future Portland, Oregon. The dreamer imagines world peace, a world without a war and enemies and so forth, wakes up to find that his dream has been realized, except in a deathly stillness, and that aliens have landed on the moon. So this world peace is achieved by a threat from the outside. Well, I mean, that just, I think, illustrates some of the problems of humanism, of what Marcuse called repressive tolerance, and so on and so forth. It's a problem, it's a dilemma, it's an antinomy. It's not something one doesn't wish to attack these ideals, but they're contradictory ideals, and I don't know whether humanism today has that kind of political, the kind of political force needed. Yesterday I quoted, it's a wonderful sentence of Deleuze that I found someplace, that someone found and used as a motto. Deleuze says, we mustn't waste any time lamenting the present or hoping about the future. What we really need is to invent new weapons. And I don't think by that he meant nuclear bombs either. But concepts. Yeah, somebody over there, yeah, way back in the corner.
Thank you. Yeah, could you speak a little more about the difference between autonomy and singularity in your critique? I know you prefaced the talk by saying it wasn't mainly about aesthetics, but if, as recent research suggests, modernists laid claim to an autonomy that didn't exist, or in your terms was semi-autonomous at best, does that not influence the definition of postmodernism either as continuous with certain anti-modern aspects of modernism or as something else?
Well, there you raise a larger periodized question about periods. I mean, are we to think in terms of breaks or continuities and so forth? I tend to follow Foucault, who is the sort of theoretician of the break in historiography, and think that if it's continuous, if it just comes out of the past, then one can do much less with historical description than one can if one assumes that there are breaks between these periods and oppositions between them. But I think that's that choice, historiographic choice, is a leap in the void. There can't be any philosophical justification for it either way. That is, you have to decide it. It's not something given. Now, you're talking about autonomy. Well, autonomy sort of has become, on all levels, a kind of universal value, right? I mean, it's being emancipated. It's being, what do we say when we talk about non-minor, it's coming of age, it's being individually free and responsible and so on and so forth. In the arts, it's also a matter of moving towards the uniqueness of that specific medium, like oil paint or language or whatever, which is predicated on having a radical difference from other from the other arts or media, and yet having a genuine essence of their own. So I still think those are universal things, and I don't think that those concepts are really really correspond to much in postmodernity. But maybe that's a much longer discussion than I'm able to give you right now.
Maybe
one more. Yeah. Somebody here, maybe. Yeah. Yes, it's.
You mentioned like Tahrir Square and Tiananmen and the Occupy protests as sort of instances of a new kind of political postmodern temporality. And I'm wondering if you see that same kind of comportment towards time as early as the kind of 1968 movement, or if there was a rupture after that.
I guess that's right. Yes, of course. This comes out of 68. And 68 is... Everybody felt that it was something new, so it had to be something new in that sense. And it was different, and it had the fate of a president of politics as well, since nowadays everybody's saying it's a failure. Nothing came of it, I mean, except reaction. But it remains the great ideal, I think, behind all those things. But of course, if you go back and you associate, you'd have to know, I think, and I'm not just trying to flatter us all, but I think those were essentially student demonstrations. I think the first one the May 4th movement in China in 1919. That's the first immense explosion of student demonstration that transformed everything, culture, and everything else. So these things are not unknown in the past, but it's the multiplication of them since Seattle that's made this paradigmatic in some sense for, if you can get out enough people, the tyrant either kills you if he has an army, or leaves, or is found and killed. It seems to me that's rather different than the model of revolutions that we know in the past from Cuba on back. So something new is happening there, but it's problematic because it lasts for this very powerful moment, and then we don't know what followed. The Negri article is called, actually, I think he talks about Jefferson in that, constituted versus constitutive power. Of course, these terms come from the French Revolution, la constituante, and so on. That this between the systems, there's a moment of freedom, exhilaration. Malraux called it the lyric illusion. And then suddenly there has to be law again, and somebody writes a constitution, and everything shuts down. So there is that tremendous moment of exhilaration in between these two systems. But that's not necessarily so wonderful a prospect either, I imagine, or at least so energizing a prospect.
Anyway. Okay, more anon. I hope to see many, although not all of you, tomorrow at noon. Thank you very much. Thank you today.